Hello, I'm Krupa Patti. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. In BBC OS Conversations, we bring people together to share their experiences. This time, we hear from people in Ukraine about life in the country after 1,000 days of war. As winter approaches and temperatures drop, Russia is targeting Ukraine's energy system, leaving millions of people without power. In our conversations, we hear from the victims of recent Russian attacks and bring together three politicians determined to keep democracy alive.
It is pretty complicated to remove the political ambitions and have the fighting behind the closed doors so that we can act as Team Ukraine to the outside world.
November the 19th marked 1,000 days since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And in the past few weeks, the fighting has intensified. Russia claimed to have used a new type of hypersonic ballistic missile in its latest attacks on Ukraine. This came after President Biden removed sanctions on the use of US long-range guided missiles by Ukraine outside its borders. As well as launching hundreds of missiles and drones at power infrastructure across the country on the front line of the fighting, some observers are claiming Russia is advancing at the fastest pace since the invasion began in 2022. Since the outbreak of the war, people caught up in the conflict have been sharing their experiences with us. And for our first two conversations, we can hear firsthand about some of the latest attacks. First, let's go to the Black Sea port of Odessa. My colleague Mart Lowin heard from Hannah and Tatiana.
My flat was totally destroyed on the Thursday night, as well as several other flats in Odessa. That was the very heavy Iranian drones attack. And they've been just falling in the historical UNESCO-protected center, given the fire and the absence of roofs. So I'm now in the middle of my flat, looking to the skies, instead of looking to the wonderful ceiling. Then each day that was the heavy attack, either of the drones or of the missiles, one left us without electricity for some districts 24 hours. I'm here also, like, no electricity in the downtown now. And today, in the middle of all of these, we found out that Russians also sent missiles to another residential area, killing a lot of people.
My situation is better because I live in another district of city. But as Anna said, it's a really shock, your situation and another people. It's terrible, and we don't have water. We have only internet. But, you know, it's a miracle, for example, that Anna and her family is alive.
Mm. Yeah, Hannah, were you not in the building when the attack happened, I assume?
No, we were in the building.
You were
we
in
were
the building.
Sitting in the sofa, yeah, decided to watch the episode.
I just can't even imagine. I mean, what did you see? What did you feel?
You know, that is the most interesting. You usually hear when it is the air defense is working or something is falling around, because that is not the first attack in this neighborhood. We are living not far from the seaport that Russians are almost each second day are trying to attack. But usually, like, you hear the sound, that's okay. This time, what was really shocking for us, that we haven't heard that big sound. So the first 30 seconds, you are not even realizing what's happened. We just saw a lot of the dust. And for our luck, we were in the further room at my office, because if we would sit in my bedroom, that would be a disastrous. There, it's fall the ceiling completely to my bed. But in this room where we were, it's been just a lot of dust and a small part of the ceiling fall together with the bulb of the light on the ceiling. And we were saved because we were covered with the blankets, like, you know, cozy evening with the movie and a big sofa. So that's helped us a little bit. It's all the shock from the Izabarik strike, as we call it, so this heating wave after the explosion, All these blankets and so far just helped us a little bit. And only when we ran away, taking at least the phone, the dog, some coat, because it is cold outside, and seeing the fire and all the people outside, we started to realize what really happened.
Hannah and Tatiana in Odessa. Next, we head northeast to Dnipro. The city was targeted earlier this month by what Russia described as a new conventional intermediate range missile. Valentina and Lydia told us what happened.
It was 5:30 in the morning, and firstly, I thought that is the regular Thompson regular that we already used to hear, like regular bombing, regular attack. But then it becomes more and loudly than usual, and it becomes the understanding that it's something new. And we have chat with the friends, and all of them feels that now we have some new experience.
I agree with Lydia here, because today this definitely was a different kind of noise. There were many explosions, and it was very scary, actually, because we woke up from these sounds. Yeah, it was kind of scary.
Like the very first bombshell in of the February, 3 years ago, when we
in
woke
2022.
Up. Yes, when we woke up because of the explosions.
Just tell me what life has been like in Dnipro in recent weeks.
It's hard to explain, actually, because our city is totally affected by the war, and all the news and all the new information that we have is affect our emotional and totally all for our life. That's how it feels. It's hard to explain, Lydia. Maybe you can help me here.
We're being attacked not only with the rockets, but also psychologically. 3 years of war, 3 years of constant tension, 3 years of uncertainty. It's really exhausted. And I understand that it's exactly what the aggressor is counted on. We as a society have shown incredible strength, and we have united in the face of the enemy.
Lydia and Valentina in Dnipro speaking to Mark shortly after a missile attack. So how are Ukrainian families holding up after 1,000 days of war, living with the threat of near daily attacks and with many fathers, husbands and sons fighting on the front line? We brought together Alice in the capital, Kyiv, Victor, he's serving in military communications also in Kyiv, and Anastasia, she lives in Cherkasy, a city in central Ukraine.
Now I wake up pretty much every single night from all of these explosions happening outside. Our mobile air defense groups are shooting down Russian drones pretty much every single night. And a couple of minutes ago, my mom called me asking if I'm still alive, because she's so worried that something could happen to me, because we live close to this place where, yeah, it gets targeted a lot. So it's madness at this point, but we're just so used to it.
For us, the war is going on for 10 years, and the full-scale war that we can feel in Kyiv is going for 3 years. And you cannot just be in the whole that stress for 3 years. The human psyche just cannot walk this way. So you get used, and it will become some kind of strange, bizarre, eerie, but still a part of your life. Like, okay, today I must take another bus, not that bus I used to, because it will be traffic jam because of aerial alert, and some transports won't go. So it's becomes some kind of, I don't know, your daily schedule. Each night you cannot plan your sleep, because it may be that it will be aerial alert and you should move to corridor or to some shelter if you have one. So that's just some kind of, I don't know, strange living schedule during the war.
Yeah, I can agree with Victor. You cannot live in stress for all the time. Of course, sometimes during the night, I live on 25th floor. So it's the highest floor in my building. And sometimes, of course, it's scary. Also, I can see everything that's going on in the sky. And sometimes hear the missiles flying like very clear. So I get scared from time to time. But then somehow I go to sleep, because I know that tomorrow I need to do a lot of things. So this is how it's going right now. Also because of the electricity, sometimes I experience a little bit difficulties. Again, because I live on 25th floor, and now my schedule a little bit confused because of that. Because I check the schedule of the electricity. And this is how I make my plans. I don't want to walk up 25 floors.
Alice, I mean, I remember when I was in Kyiv having to go down to the bunker where we were staying a few times. I mean, do you have a bunker in the basement of your building and you have to go down 25 floors to get to it?
Yeah, I have parking lot, which is underground. Yeah, but honestly, I don't do that. I don't usually go there. I only go closer to the lift or to the corridor. I mean, it's madness to go every time there from 25th floor, especially in the winter period of time, because it's pretty cold there.
Victor, can you give us a sense of the morale in the military, a military that Russia thought could surrender within days or weeks? That has not happened. But Ukraine militarily is now on the back foot, no?
Of course, you can be tired physically, but you cannot stop saving your own life. You can stop when your life or lives of your loved ones are in grave danger. So it's not something about morale. It's about something about necessity. Well, you can, when you are drawn, you cannot just say, oh, I am tired and no. You need to fight, we need to fight, and we all understand that huge stress, and the stress is, taking its toll on your health, both physical and mental. That's, of course, a problem, but you cannot just stop.
Anastasia, how is your family coping? Have you had any losses among your loved ones, among your family and friends?
Well, to be honest, I'm very, very lucky not to have lost anyone in particular from my family. But I can't help but think about all the people in Ukraine that we have lost so far. And obviously, Ukrainians, they all understand exactly what price we are paying for our freedom in this war. Obviously, we will never bring back all the people that were killed by Russians. And yes, we are losing the gold of the nation, and obviously, the last thing I want is for more Ukrainian people to die.
Victor, as a military officer, do you draw hope from the weapons that are now being given to Ukraine by its Western allies?
Of course I do, but the thing is not maybe about weapons itself, but about decisions to use them against Russian targets on traditional Russian soil. That's great, that can help, because for a long time it was like football game with only one gate. We just was in a pure defensive position, and you cannot just defend all the time. So for us, it's maybe an ability to disrupt Russian infrastructure, Russian military infrastructure, before they get to us, before they will try to kill us right here on our ground. However, I don't believe that there is some kind of game breaker or game changer or some wonder waffle that specifically will help us to end the war in a few months. No. That's not going to happen for now. And I believe still many things depend from the position of our international partners, not even in military aspect, but in diplomacy and politics.
I wanted to agree, because it's not only about battlefield, it's also political question, you know, because we need a strategy. Of course, it's very good that our Western partners are giving us weapons. Yeah, it's going to help us, and maybe it's going to help us to defend and to save more lives. But we need a strategy, how to use them, as Victor said. And yeah, it's a question of diplomacy as well, because we need to influence somehow to Russia. Maybe we can have some kind of a deal, if it's even possible, because I'm not sure right now.
Alice, Victor and Anastasia talking to my colleague Mark Lowen. This is BBC OS Conversations with me, Krupa Party, from the BBC World Service. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump pledged to swiftly end the war in Ukraine. Before he comes to power as US president in January, this latest series of strikes suggests Russia is turning up the pressure to try to push home its current military advantage, forcing Ukraine to the negotiating table in a weaker position. For our final conversation, we wanted to hear from three Ukrainians in politics, not just grappling with major decisions about the war and dealing with Ukraine's allies, but also the day-to-day business of running a democratic country. Mark was joined in our London studio by Volodymyr Omelyan, a former Minister of Infrastructure who joined the army when Russia invaded in 2022, and from Kyiv by opposition MPs Ina Sovsun and Kira Rudik.
I can tell you the story of the day one of the full-scale invasion, when Kyiv was in collapse and nobody knew what to do. But Ukrainian constitution is very clear about how the parliament should act at a time like this. I remember how we were told by our security that we would only have probably less than half of an hour at the chambers, where we have to gather and vote for the martial law to begin. And we did not know how many people would come because people were evacuating their families. Some of them were going to the front line. And when we arrived to the chambers, we looked around and we have seen that of 420 members of parliament, almost 300 came. And for the 10 minutes that we were there, we and desperately clicking our buttons to call for the world to support us, telling Ukrainian people that we are not running and that Ukrainian democracy is working and will be working. We were holding hands and singing our national anthem. It was perhaps one of the most emotional moments of my life. And at that time, we also made a vow that we will try as politicians to stand united until we win the war. And I can tell you that right now it is pretty complicated to remove the political ambitions and have the fighting behind the closed doors so that we can act as Team Ukraine to the outside world, making sure that we support our army, but also figuring out the solutions to really drastic problems that arise at the time of the full-scale invasion.
Yeah, if I can add to that, it is extremely difficult because you suddenly have to deal with a level of problems that you have never been prepared to deal with. All of us with Kira here, Volodymyr to a different extent, but other MPs who work in internationally advocating for support to Ukraine, we all suddenly had to learn lots of new things, like what types of tanks does Germany have, what is the air defense system and how many types of them are and which country has what and so on and so forth. So we suddenly had to educate ourselves about things that have never been something, you know, we have been dealing with before, but we had to learn that very, very fast in order to work efficiently on behalf of the Ukrainian people internationally. And then in terms of legislative work, it took some time to get adjusted to this new reality and to figure out what the parliament as a legislative body can do. But I think majority of the MPs did find a way how to develop legislation that will actually be helping to solve the problem that particularly the army is facing. I serve in the Energy Committee, actually, and there is lots of work that needs to get done on the energy side of things. But we all had to expand our expertise and start dealing with the military issue and to get an understanding of those issues to a much bigger extent compared to what majority of us have been dealing with before.
Andina, Kira talked about MPs coming together in Team Ukraine, that sense of real national unity. Do you believe that that political unity still exists as doubts and criticism have grown over the last few months, particularly towards President Zelensky? Have the normal political divisions, if you like, begun to creep back in?
Well, they clearly have to an extent. And I do think that it is, on the one hand, it can be seen as a worrying sign. But on the other hand, the reality is that it shows that Ukraine is a democracy. It's okay for a democratic state to have political debates. It's okay to have different views. It's okay to have different positions and to be able to communicate them publicly. If we stayed in a situation where everybody is only saying the same and everybody can only provide the same ideas, that would be, Putin's Russia. That is where they stay on the same page, absolutely 100% of them. So, of course, there are some divisions internally. I wouldn't say it's necessarily a sign of weakness. I would say that it is a sign of, democracy functioning. And, of course, there are some things that we are not happy about. With me, Kira, are representing the opposition political parties. So we do have our own concerns about, some corruption scandals erupting and some other issues. But again, I would suggest that we look at this as part of the democratic process as it should be.
You know, I was a strong opponent to Zelensky before the big invasion of Russia. But on the first day of invasion, I decided not to criticize him at all. And in 2022, 2023, I would say that 99% of Ukrainians were silent about any mistakes. But it cannot last forever, because all those mistakes have double price during wartime. What is done wrong by politicians in peacetime, it could lead to some breaks in economy or problems with some social welfare or something like that. But in wartime, the price for mistake is lives of our citizens. And that's why we think we have the right to criticize, to show those mistakes with the demand to change the attitude, to change the behavior, to change the leadership to have this war with less losses for Ukrainian economy, for Ukrainian people. Otherwise, it will cost us too much. It's already too much for Ukraine, but still, we don't want to have this figure doubled.
Kira, can I ask how you feel now with the prospect of an incoming Donald Trump administration in Washington and the discussion? I mean, I wonder whether this is being discussed in Parliament among your MPs. I assume it is. Whether, you know, the US is going to cut off military aid to Ukraine and what sort of deal Donald Trump might force Ukraine to stomach.
So, Mark, what is very important for everyone to realize is that our dedication and our initial decision to fight in Ukraine, it did not change. And the main question when anyone is talking about some agreement or a peace deal for us is, and it's not emotional, it's facts, that we are showing that the peace deal and agreements with Russia actually don't work. We have been in some discussion and negotiation with them since 2014, I think like what, 200 times. And before there is an understanding who or what in the whole world are able to make sure that Russia will keep their part of the bargain, that they will not attack us again. Actually, there cannot be discussion about any kind of the negotiation. And as of right now, what we have heard from Donald Trump and his team is the initiative to end the war in 24 hours. Well, I can tell you there is a way of ending the war in 24 hours is pressuring Putin into pulling back his troops up to our initial borders. That will be the good way of ending the war. Unfortunately, we are not sure if that's what Donald Trump and his team have in mind. And of course, people here in Ukraine are worried of what kind of a solution can be from one of our strongest partners, the United States. I hope that they are still in investigating phase and do not have any plan in mind. And I know that there are many members of parliament and there are many politicians who are working with the Republican teams trying to explain what a threat Russia and China and Iran and North Korea pose, and that any kind of the peace deal would not stop them from ramping up their military production and from just arming up to attack us or any other state again and again and again. And right now in Ukraine, we have already paid an enormous price to be where we are right now. So the best solution from our allies would be to arm us enough so we can finish the job, other than figuring out a way of how to appease the dictator once again.
Ukrainian MPs Kira and Inna, and also former Minister Volodymyr, talking to Mark Lowen. I'm Krupa Bhatti, and you've been listening to the documentary with conversations on life in Ukraine after 1,000 days of war from the BBC World Service.